Welcome, everyone, to Wise Talk. This is Mariposa's monthly leadership forum. Today, we're thrilled to have David Rogers. David is a member of the faculty at Columbia Business School and is a globally recognized leader on digital business strategy, known for his pioneering model of customer networks and his work on digital transformation. He's also the founder and co-host of Columbia's acclaimed Bright Conference on Brands, Innovation, and Technology. David has consulted and developed custom executive programs and strategic workshops for executives in hundreds of companies all over the world, such as GE, Google, Toyota, SAP, and IBM. David is the author of four books, including The Network is Your Customer, and his new book, The Digital Transformation Playbook, Rethink Your Business for the Digital Age. He delivers keynotes at conferences worldwide on digital transformation, digital marketing, big data, and the impact of emerging technologies on business. He has appeared on CNN, ABC, NBC, Marketplace, Channel News Asia, and in the Financial Times, Wall Street Journal, Forbes, and The Economist. Wow, that's awesome. So really looking forward to talking with you about your new book, particularly. It was the book that we featured in our monthly newsletter. And before we get into that, let me, so welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me, Sue. It's a real pleasure to join you.
And especially because it's at the end of your day, so appreciate that. You can get a hold of David and follow him on Twitter, which is how we found him. And his Twitter handle is @David_Rogers, and that's R-O-G-E-R-S, so no D. So welcome, David. And tell us a little bit about your path, your career path. How did you get to Columbia, write these books? How did you decide to focus on digital transformation?
You know, looking back at the beginning, I took the typical career path, studying physics and jazz composition in college, being an improvising saxophonist, to starting a record label, becoming a business owner in the music industry, moving into marketing, branding, establishing a research center at an Ivy League school, doing programming conferences, research, case studies, book writing, teaching, and typical sort of sequence. But I've been kind of working in the area of marketing and brands for almost 20 years now, and at Columbia, researching and teaching. And for the last, dozen years or so, I've really been focusing increasingly on technology and really looking at the sort of intersection of emerging technologies and behavior and how that impacts, individuals and organizations and how we create value as businesses. So that's led to things like the Bright Conference, as you mentioned, which I started 9 years ago. We're heading into our 10th year next spring, which is sort of focusing each year in New York on brands, innovation, and technology. So bringing together, CMOs from companies like a Pepsi or a L'Oreal or an American Express with technology companies like Facebook or IBM or Google, as well as media companies being in New York, whether it's the New York Times or BuzzFeed or Netflix, and, startups and, founders of companies like, MakerBot and Zipcar and Warby Parker, et cetera. Through the conferences and my research and work at Columbia, I started writing, feeling the itch to write longer form and got into book writing several years ago. This is my fourth, and the last two have really focused specifically on looking at how digital technologies are changing business strategy. And the last book was very much focused on customers, understanding the core drivers of customer behaviors and thinking about customers as networks and using that as a way to figure out how any business can create valuable strategies for customers. And the new book is really focused on this big question that so many companies I hear today are grappling with, which is commonly called digital transformation.
Yeah, it's interesting because customers are being used. I mean, I think the best example is Yelp, right? What the customers are saying makes a much bigger difference now than it used to. So much of innovation now is about customer centric, and and using the customer data more. So is that what you're finding?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's I heard a terrific marketing thinker who was actually, we had at the Marketing Hall of Fame recently, made an offhand remark that digital is extremely important, but it's a tactic and you still need to figure out your strategy behind it. I would actually argue that it's very misleading and a missed opportunity if you think of what's happening in digital technologies purely as a series of tactics. But it is important that you have to step back and think about things other than the technologies. And I think the most important place to start is looking at your customers and understanding the reason that digital, so to speak, digital technologies matter so much to businesses is because they matter to your customers. They're changing actually the relationship you have to customers. It's not just another channel for promotion and marketing and outbound communications the way that marketing was built as a discipline in the 20th century on this kind of mass media model. It's not just another set of channels for pushing messages. It actually flips the whole relationship, which is why I talk about thinking about customers as networks and understanding that they're all connected through Yelp and mobile search as they're walking down the street and social media and so many tools and platforms they have right now that they can discover and learn and compare and interact and influence each other and share information and shape your brand and even launch businesses and influence opportunities for you in so many much more dynamic ways that it poses challenges to traditional organizations. It creates a lot of new opportunities, but it really is a shift in the whole kind of relationship that businesses have to have with customers. And that's the more important and I would say the trickier thing than simply saying, oh, well, let's hire a young person to put up our Facebook page, launch a Snapchat account, et cetera.
Right.
It's not so much about the tactics. Yeah.
So we just sort of touched upon one of the domains. In your book, you talk about five domains, and so we start touching upon that a little bit, customers being one of them. What I'd like to do is start talk today about the five domains, and then I have some sort of areas I want to go into to apply this, because people who are on the phone are going to be mostly managers, executives, some coaches, some consultants who work with those executives and managers. So it's not just marketing people, although I know we have a few marketing people on the phone.
Yes.
So I want to be able to apply these ideas to something beyond marketing. And of course, there's plenty of ways to do that. So if you wanted to say some more about customers in terms of being one of those domains, and I know that we'll talk about competition, data, innovation, and value. If you could just kind of go through all those.
And the scope of the book really is across all those domains. It is much broader than marketing, this book in particular. And, when I started, I had to sort of first ask myself, well, what do we even mean by digital transformation? I was speaking in Rome a few weeks ago, and the gentleman who introduced me said, every business I speak to today is talking about digital transformation. But the question I have is this just an empty suitcase? Everyone is carrying it around, but no one knows what's inside it.
That's awesome. A great
aphorism from the Italians. So I've stolen it from him. So to me, digital transformation is really a pretty simple thing. It's really a question. And the question is, how does a business, an enterprise that was started before the digital era, need to adapt in order to grow and thrive and reach its next stage of profitable growth in a very different environment today that is being driven and shaped by so many different factors of digital technology.
Mm-hmm.
And as I spent time digging into this question, how do these organizations from the pre-digital era need to adapt or change? What is the sort of critical success factor? What I found was that digital transformation is really not fundamentally about technology. Well, that's not the difficult part or the critical part. It's really about changing strategic thinking, changing the way that you think as an organization, changing the way that we as leaders think about our businesses and define opportunities and understand challenges. Because organizations are like people, and the way that they think is based on their prior experiences. So if you have an organization like a GE or New York Times, or all kinds of companies that I talk about in the book, retailers, traditional physical retailers, all kinds of companies. If you were started and evolved and built as a business in a very different environment, it's only natural that the way the organization thinks, it's going to be shaped by that history, and it's going to come to new situations with a set of assumptions that are probably unrecognized. And so the goal of the book, as I structured around these five domains of strategy, is to look at each of them and see how we as businesses have to learn to just stretch and adapt and upgrade our thinking, if you will, in each of these areas, how we think about customers, how we think about competition and data and innovation and value. And I can say, you know, a little bit about each of these and delve into them further.
Yeah, just kind of hit upon a couple of them, yeah.
Yeah. So,
I mean, hit upon all of them, but I mean, just a little bit on each would be great. Yeah.
So, you know, the real shift that I see in terms of customers, as I mentioned, is that businesses are needing to shift from thinking about their customers as targets, who you market to thinking about them as networks, looking at them as active, dynamic participants and partners who you have a much more reciprocal, dynamic relationship with. And as you understand the ways that they're interacting with each other in their environment, you get a better insight into their very rapidly changing path to purchase and the ways that the decisions are made by customers. In terms of competition, we're shifting from a world where competition was very much a zero-sum game, with black and white competition, with you are with us or against us, your competitors or your partners. And instead, we're in an environment where increasingly companies are dealing with frenemies or co-opetition. You know, the same company may be your fiercest rival and also a critical business partner. You look at companies like Google and Apple, duking it out, battling for supremacy as the operating system of computing in the mobile era. And at the same time, as was uncovered in some recent court documents, Google has been paying Apple $1 billion a year to be the default search engine on the iPhone.
Right.
At the same time that they're, locked in this struggle.
Yeah.
You know, that's not a trivial partnership.
No, it's not.
So it's a very different kind of competition today, and a lot of it is between rather than symmetric competitors. So I'm a car company, I'm Ford Motors, and I'm competing with Toyota, and I'm competing with Daimler Chrysler. You know, other businesses that have a similar value proposition and also a similar business model. Instead, a lot of competition is around asymmetric competitors. So you're competing with another company with a totally different business model. That may be providing a competing offer, a similar value proposition to the same customer. So, you know, if you're an automotive company, you're thinking not just about auto manufacturers, but you're thinking about, well, is Uber going to reduce the need for families to buy a second car?
Yeah, exactly.
You know, because they say, well, we'll buy one and we'll use, you know, ride sharing services and this more sort of, you know, liquid capability. The third domain is data.
Mm-hmm.
Data is not new. Data has always been part of how businesses operate. But there's a real shift right now in the role that data plays within businesses. So traditionally, data has operated, been used in a siloed fashion. It's been very operational in its purposes. Data is used as part of how you get things done within the different parts of your organization. And so a company would have product data, consumer market research data, you know, inventory data, and it sits in these different silos in different parts of the business and is used to help just operate more efficiently and effectively. But today what's happening, and that tended to be data you have to go out and get. You spend money to generate reports and capture data and measure it, certainly any kind of market data. Now data is everywhere. It's being given off by everything. There's this incredible sea change in unstructured data, which is commonly called big data, although size is really not the distinguishing factor. But at the same time, what we're seeing is that businesses that can bring this data together in an integrated fashion, instead of just being a way of improving your efficiency in your operations, it actually becomes a strategic asset that can be used to create new value and to innovate and drive the business forward. So
that sounds good. Could you give us an example of that? I mean, that makes sense.
Yeah.
Can you give us an example of that?
So you know, a couple of examples I talked about in the book. One is the weather company, which is a traditional media company that, you know, figured out, tracked the weather and gave weather forecasts and operated on a traditional, you know, weather business, a media company business model. You know, you create content that people want to watch or tune in or listen to or read, and then you sell advertising against it. But, and of course, to get this done every day, they needed to have a lot of meteorological data. But at a certain point, a few years ago, the capabilities of data and unstructured data were improving, they started to realize that this was a powerful strategic asset. And so they started unlocking a lot of new applications for this data other than just telling you, you know, what to wear, or if you're a farmer, maybe, you know, how to manage your farming. But they found they could work with big box retailers, for example, and predict based on weather patterns in different locations, which kinds of products people are more likely to buy on a given day, which could lead to inventory and merchandising decisions as well as real-time advertising decisions. So you could be pushing a digital advertisement to someone promoting one snack food versus a different snack food or stocking a different one on the shelves based on the fact that you know that when the weather is hot and humid versus when it is hot and dry, people actually buy slightly different foods. You know, this kind of thing. They work with insurance companies to take the data and create tools so that, you know, they created an app called Hail Zone so that auto insurance customers, people with a car insurance policy, could get an alert when hail was nearby and there was a chance of it hitting where their car was, so that they would park it inside and not have expensive damage to the car, which, you know, the driver doesn't want to have to deal with the hassle and the insurance company doesn't want to deal with the bill. So they started finding lots of different ways that they could use this data, partnering with other kinds of industries to generate lots more value. They wound up actually getting bought by IBM because it turned into such a valuable asset.
Weather company got bought by IBM.
Yes, yeah. Wow, the weather company was bought by IBM this year as part of IBM's desire to really become a key leader in cloud-based big data services for companies. They said this is a really valuable set of data. Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah. Okay.
I talk about
innovation,
right? So that's the fourth domain. And innovation, we're seeing a really big shift in the digital era from the traditional model of innovation was really based on senior leaders and smart people in the organization making tough decisions and placing big bets, right? Innovation is supposed to be bold. It's inherently risky, and so you get the smartest people you know to decide the course of action, and you go there and you hope it pans out. And now we're shifting to a model which is based on a process which I call rapid experimentation. And so the goal, the role of leadership is actually very different. Instead of trying to figure out the answer, leaders need to set the goal and the question of innovation and enable their organization to get out and figure out how they can very effectively, low risk, high return, learn as quickly and rapidly as possible and test out and explore ideas so that they don't seek everything into one giant bet that might or might not work, and rather can be much more in the market, testing, learning, gathering data, figuring out which product direction, which new service, which retail experience is actually going to work and create an opportunity for the business, taking the sort of thinking that you see inside startups or inside purely digital companies like a Google or an Amazon, who are constantly experimenting and testing every aspect of their customer experience, and actually applying that in anything, you know, retail banking to, you know, consumer products and packaged goods or electronics, any kind of business innovation. And the fifth domain, which I talk about in the book, is value. How do you define your value as a business? You know, the big question, why do we exist as a company? What business am I in? And traditionally, this tends to be answered through looking at your industry. You know, you said, well, I'm a newspaper business. I tell the news and I print newspapers, and we have, you know, the following columns and sections of the paper. Or I'm a car company, I'm a hotel company. But what's happening is industry definitions and borders or barriers are becoming much more fluid and evolving. And as the environment changes for business, we need to shift from taking a sort of static view of defining who we are, which leads to really a question when you see every new technology, the sort of traditional, the natural reflex of an existing business is to look at every new technological trend and say, well, how does this affect my business? Right? In other words, how does this affect my existing business model? It's inherently a defensive question. And instead, I would argue, any business should look at every new change and ask itself, how could this create a new opportunity for me to deliver value to my customers, which I wasn't able to deliver yesterday? If you take that, it means you are constantly evolving and looking to adapt your value proposition. Say, why do I exist as a business? What is our value to the world, to the market, to our customers? And you don't wait, ideally, until, you know, you're falling off a cliff and your business, you know, the asteroid is coming at you and your old business model is about to collapse. But you're skating where the puck is. You're seeing where things are going, and you're thinking, rethinking on a continuous basis where your business is going, so that you're evolving before you have, you know, no choice but to be
right.
disrupted.
So not be Netflix, in other words.
To not be Blockbuster.
Right. Yeah, well, not be, right.
Exactly.
Not be Netflix. No, Blockbuster got Netflix by Netflix. Yeah, okay.
So
given that, so those five areas to me seem very, you know, you're trying to illuminate what it is, what it means to be strategic, particularly being a strategic thinker, rather than just being, you know, oftentimes people think of strategy as planning, but I think that I'm with you that I think that strategy is more about being a strategic thinker. So these you feel are the five areas to think about. So let's take what I would call a case study or something in the book that can illuminate at least a couple of these, something that maybe is close to home here, something that in terms of technology companies potentially, or applying things that are happening. I like what you said about the Bright Conference, where you're bringing, you know, technology companies with you know, beauty companies and media companies. I think that's really good because I think we can learn from each other. So help us understand a couple of these strategic thinking factors, if you would.
So, well, I'll give a couple examples. We can talk about a couple cases from different parts of the book. So, you know, one of the companies that I look at is when I talk about evolving your value proposition is the Metropolitan Museum of Art.
Not
a sort of conventional, you know, company on your list, but a really interesting organization that's, you know, been a leader in its category for years. And however, they're not sitting still. They're continually asking themselves, look, the world around us is changing. How is technology changing the way that our audience experiences aesthetics, art, culture, history? And how can the role, or how should the role of the museum evolve and change in order to adapt and to be as meaningful and relevant as possible? And so they've been thinking about this a lot of ways. I mean, they've been doing things for a number of years, digitizing, tagging all of the artwork in their entire collection and creating digital assets related to it. More recently, they had their first chief digital officer. They created that position. The first one was my friend Sri Srinivasan, and he, while he was there, was leading a team of about 40 people. Really, you know, the Met has its main branch on Fifth Avenue. It has an uptown branch, the Cloisters, which focuses on medieval art. They've recently added the Met Broyer, which is focused on modern art. But as he said, they've seen for the last decade, they've been thinking about their whole digital presence as another branch of the museum. And so they're doing everything from creating educational resources, obviously, you know, obvious things like creating a great app, you know, a mobile app that is not jam-packed with every possible thing you could put in it, which is what tends to happen when businesses build their own apps, but it's just an intuitive experience for the visitor who's planning a visit or has just walked in the door and downloaded the app to find out what's happening in the museum right now and what exhibitions they might want to discover and where they can go for each of them. But they've also done things like rethinking, you know, the lifespan of a work of art. You know, typically a painting is acquired by the Met, and there's about a six-month period during which it is documented and archived. Information is researched about who owned it previously and everything that's known about the history of the work. Preservationists will come in and clean it up and prepare it and do any preparation to protect the artwork or remove, you know, debris or dust or sediment that is, you know, accrued on it before it finally appears on the walls. Now, traditionally, no one would ever see any of this until it actually, you know, the painting is hanging on the wall and then it's visible to the public. But, you know, what their digital team has done is they've started telling stories through short-form video and blogging and other means of this whole process. You know, what did they acquire? Why did they take this painting? What are they learning about it in their research? How is it being prepared? What needed to be done to protect it? And they find that people all over the world are fascinated by this, and they're watching and they're learning and they're engaging with it in a whole different way, even people who've never walked in the doors of the museum. They've done things, they've created things like, you know, mobile games for younger visitors where it's a, you know, a murder mystery whodunit, but to get each clue you have to go to a different part of the museum and visit an actual, you know, masterwork like, you know, Madame X by John Singer Sargent and gaze deeply, you know, at the artwork and learn something about it to figure out the next step in the game. And they've done things where they're working with outside partners, like they had a hackathon where they opened up to outside parties the data sets that they built on all of their artworks, which has led to things like a project by Regina Flores-Mir, a Brooklyn-based multimedia performance artist who created something called the Hip Hop Project, where it's basically a web app where you can pick among songs by Kanye West, Drake, Jay-Z, Missy Elliott, I believe. And when you pick a song and it starts and you start it playing, as the song is playing, the app is scanning the lyrics and picking out the keywords within the lyrics of the song and scanning through the whole database of the Met's artwork and picking out different artworks that are tagged with that same word or concept or idea. So as you're listening to the song, you're getting this, seeing this visual collage from throughout human history that relates to the themes and the concepts of the song. These are the kinds of things, you know, they never wouldn't have been possible, you know, a few years ago, and you couldn't really have imagined them a few years ago. And the trick is to be ready and open to imagine them yourself or in partnership with others as new possibilities open up. And because, as you know, Sheree said, that the challenge is not necessarily other museums. It's, you know, it's Netflix, it's Candy Crush, it's Pokemon Go, you know, this week. How do you make sure that a museum like the Met is still relevant and enriching and engaging in people's lives and become as still as vital as it's been in previous
generations? That was actually my question, is like, are they doing this because they're just providing more services and trying to help people think outside the box so they stay relevant? So I that was the answer to my question.
Yeah, and I think for a lot of businesses that's the question. It's how do I be as relevant to my customer, whomever that may be, today and going forward as I've been in the past.
Yeah, it's interesting. As an aside, I'll tell you that I just went to the San Francisco MoMA. They just reopened it, and I hope that when you come here, whenever you come here next year, you go there, because it really, and for all of you on the call, it's they've really transformed it. So talk about, you know, a transformation and as well as a digital transformation. There's lots of things there that are I would call digital, but it's three times as big. So that's really does.
Yeah.
I think it really does compete now with the MoMA in New York, actually. But as an aside, all right, let's.
Excellent. I'll look forward to it online.
So thanks for bringing up that about the Met. So continuing our discussion around the idea of being more strategic in terms of our thinking, one of the things that I saw in your book here, as I'm looking through, and is the idea of rethinking your business as a platform. You're thinking of your products as actually platforms rather than products.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
At what you offer as a platform, and you use the example of Airbnb. Of course, here we have Lyft and we have Uber. And I remember hearing Marc Andreessen speak probably 3 years ago now.
Yeah.
More than that, 4 years ago, when Lyft was still just kind of at infancy, and he was talking about why he was so excited about it, because they were investing in it. It's not because of what the outcome is in terms of, you know, you get a Lyft in your car. It's actually the platform itself and how interesting it is and the algorithms it takes to do that.
Yeah, so platforms
talk a little bit about that. Talk a little bit about that, if you would.
Yeah. So the chapter, it's in my chapter on competition, which is actually called Build Platforms, Not Just Products. And I talk about a lot of the shifts in competition in the digital era are being driven by the growth of platform business models. The word platform is used in different ways. You know, sometimes people just use it to mean a distribution channel or a product you can add on to, a brand you can extend. But in terms of what Andreessen is talking about, in terms of understanding competition and business models, and what makes a Lyft or an Uber or an Airbnb so different as an organization, it's a platform as a business model. And that is, it's a business that creates value by facilitating interactions, direct interactions between different types of customers. So it's a really interesting shift. Instead of the business creating all the value itself, how you would traditionally, you know, run a hotel or create a software product or electronics, et cetera. Instead, you are as a business are creating value by bringing together these different parties that are each contributing and exchanging different kinds of value themselves and make the whole thing work. Mm-hmm. So we see this in service platforms like an Airbnb or an Uber, you know, where you're bringing together two kinds of people, hosts and renters, or drivers, freelance drivers and riders. We see it in, you know, in fundraising platforms like Donors Choose, where they bring together, you know, school teachers who are seeking grants with donors who are interested in discovering and supporting them. You know, media platforms like a YouTube, where you've got the creators and you've got a much larger pool of people who are viewing, and you have advertisers, and these different parties are all coming in. YouTube isn't creating, you know, Google is not creating all this content, but they created this incredible engine for growth. And, you know, platforms have really been taken off in the digital age because digital technologies have allowed some really important changes. You have frictionless acquisition of new customers who can come on, you know, through a digital interface and immediately start, you know, uploading their content on YouTube or loading in or, you know, showing their apartment on Airbnb, et cetera. You can growth can scale through, you know, architecture like cloud computing without a ceiling, you know, and grow incredibly fast. And, you know, when Airbnb moved into Cuba, it was the first American business to move into Cuba. You know, unlike a traditional hotel chain, they didn't need to buy or build or lease real estate and go out and take a lot of resumes and start hiring staff to you know, turn down the sheets and so forth. You know, they just flipped the switch on their website to say, all right, we're now taking reservations, so to speak, from an additional market. So digital allows for this incredible growth, for on-demand access and speed to these business models, and also some really important tools for trust, because anonymity, which is, you know, useful in some areas of our digital lives, you know, if you're going on a platform, you're going to a driver, for example, who's going to take you somewhere, you want to know that there's some kind of system where this other party in the ecosystem is somehow trustworthy. And in fact, a lot of markets, it's not so much an issue in the U.S., but when I talk to people in other parts of the world, in some places, the most valuable part of an Uber or a Lyft or Didi Chuxing, the Chinese version, that business model, is actually the verification and the reliability of the driver.
Totally.
Provided.
Yeah, or the renter,
Totally.
Okay, let's stop for a second because we talked a lot of really interesting ideas. So first we talked, mm-hmm. you know, about the five different domains. Let me just go over those again. Of course, customers, thinking of them as networks rather than targets, competition, data, innovation, and value. And then we talked a little bit about the Met and used that as an example. And then we talked about platforms instead of products. So I want to stop for a second and invite the group that's on the phone to ask questions.
Hi, this is Sharon. Hi, how are you?
Hi, Sharon.
Hi, Sharon.
The question I have, David, I really love what you're talking about, and your book is amazing.
Thank you.
What I'm curious about is, could you relate some of this to a service industry?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, service industries are, you know, there are a number of cases throughout the book, but I would say how you're going to create services going forward is very much, you know, going to be involving your customers perhaps in a more active way. A lot of service industries are actually moving towards platforms, or platforms are being launched in a lot of service industries. So that's both a potential opportunity as well as a potential threat if you need to recognize that. You know, looking at something like, obviously, in the case of, you know, taxis and hotels, as we spoke of Uber and Airbnb, although it's important to figure out what's your point of differentiation. Not every business is a platform that necessarily the best model. I talk about in the book about a company like Zappos, who originally was going to be a platform for other companies to sell shoes to customers. But they wound up discovering that their real differentiating factor was the quality of their customer service. And so they decided to hire, you know, their own staff and buy the inventory so they could manage the entire process. But platforms are having a big impact on everything from law firms to you know, hospitality industries. Data is really important. I would say is maybe the most important of these five to even start thinking about as any kind of a service industry, is how can you better use the data around your customers, really from the lowest hanging fruit, the simplest things in terms of how do we communicate with our audience and not treat every customer, every person we know, every client the same way, to really tracking the value of relationships with different customers in our service business and understanding how we can prioritize those who are most important to us and make sure that we are delivering a relevant experience to them. I talk about the case of Caesars Casinos, actually, in that chapter, and how by using customer data, they can figure out, you know, who's having a good stay or not among the repeat customers who are in their loyalty program. And actually, British Airways is a similar case in there. Interact with the customer differently, face-to-face, with your face-to-face employees, but using that data that's being gathered digitally. So I think that's particularly important for service businesses of any kind to be thinking about.
Thanks very much.
Hi, my name is Molly. I do have a question. I was wondering, David, how do you get around your digital immigrants as customers, people who aren't really familiar with technology, if you're wanting to get data from them?
Well, I think, you know, getting data from your customers is an important, you know, challenge for any company today. Because customer data, and I talk about the different types of data that go into any business strategy, but customer data is one of the most important for any organization. In my own research, I actually did a study at the beginning of the year that I cite in the book with my colleague Matt Quint at Columbia, looking at data sharing. The study is called "What is the Future of Data Sharing?" If you like, you can Google it. It's actually for free, published by Columbia Business School. And we're really looked at this question of how do you get customers to share data with you? There's certain kinds of data you can gather, you can just observe and measure, or even maybe get from third parties. But really, the best data is very often something that the customer is going to provide, so you know that it's valid and verified and up to date. And we found, you know, a few factors. Industry is an influencer. Certain industries people are more comfortable sharing their data with, such as financial services, more than something like airlines or e-commerce. We looked at global markets, found there were some differences between different parts of the world, Europe, Asia, and the U.S. Definitely differences among age groups. And this may correlate to your question about digital immigrants. It may not be so much that certain people are maybe less savvy or less actively using technologies, as it is true that we found, and it confirmed, our study confirmed the general perception that younger customers, you know, Generation X and even more millennials and younger, are more open to the idea of sharing data with customers. And you are going to have some customers who are more or less willing. We found a difference in sort of mindset between those who are more defensive around the data and those who are more open to sharing it. But the biggest thing we found that applies to any company is two really great factors, two opportunities. One is brand trust. We found that even when an individual was in general not comfortable or was hesitant to share data with businesses, if there was a particular brand who they felt they had a trusted relationship with more than 6 months, they were much more likely to share their data with them. So building brand trust in all the traditional means really actually opens up the doors to being able to ask your customers for more information, which you can use to better serve them. And the other thing is people are really influenced by the perception that there's actually value being exchanged. When they feel that by giving the data to your company, that they can see that it actually allows you to serve them better, to give them more relevant information, to offer the right variation on your products or services, et cetera, they're much more open to the idea of sharing data. So I think it's going to be a real success factor, both of those, for businesses going forward, is the ability to build brand trust and the ability to show that by sharing data with you, the customer actually gets a richer, more engaging, more relevant, more useful experience or service from you as they do business with your firm.
Great. Thank you, David, on that. So I've got two more questions, and then we're going to wrap it up. The first question has to do with focusing on innovation and talking about the difference between convergent and divergent experiments and how they play a critical role in innovation.
Great. So in the chapter on innovation, I talk about this idea of learning through experiments. And experimentation is really just, broadly speaking, an iterative process of learning what doesn't work. And so thinking about innovation as a series of experiments is really organizing your innovation process around learning, which is really critical to any kind of innovation. If you're just in the dark, how are you going to know what's the right opportunity, what's really going to both suit the needs of your customers and also be, you know, sustainable and feasible from a business process point of view. But when we talk about experiments, and a lot of companies in Silicon Valley and elsewhere talk about this idea of how do we experiment or learn in real time, what I found is that there's actually a couple different types of experiments. And as a manager, it's important to understand the distinction because you use them differently for different innovation challenges. So one type is what I call convergent experiments. Now, the name comes because you're starting with a specific question and you're converging on an answer. It's an experiment that's seeking to provide a specific answer. So this could be something like an A-B test, as it's commonly called. You know, you're trying to figure out what is the right call to action in your email, what is the right design of a web page, what is the right feature combination or the right price point for a particular product. And these experiments can actually be designed with following a scientific method in the sense of a controlled experiment with a causal hypothesis, testing control groups, randomly assigned participants, statistically valid sample size, and blind testing. In the ideal situation, sometimes you have to get, you know, most of that, but not quite perfect. But that's that sort of approach, and I look at examples from the digital design world of something like a Google to the rougher but still well-applied example of retailers like a Wawa, convenience store, figuring out, well, what is the actual impact on the profit in our stores if we change certain food items or products that we're selling, rather than just saying, well, we've got an innovation and let's just roll it out and kind of cross our fingers and see what happens. On the other hand, we have other kinds of experiments that people talk about in terms of when we hear people talking about, you know, minimum viable products and design thinking and experimenting to discover new opportunities. This is what I call a divergent experiment. There's not a single specific question like an A-B test. And so you're posing actually an unknown set of questions, and it requires a different sort of process design. This is where you're putting a prototype in the hands of customers. You're discovering through an iterative process what opportunity may be most meaningful for your business. So the process may actually generate new questions at each stage as well as answering questions so far that you've generated so far. And the ultimate goal is to test as many assumptions as possible behind a general idea or of an innovation direction that you're thinking of, and to explore them and both generate ideas as well as validate the sort of assumptions behind them. And this tends to be, the distinction is divergent experiments tend to work really well in the early stages of innovation, where you're exploring and generating ideas and discovering opportunities. And the other kind, the convergent that I mentioned first, those are very useful in later stages. They're great for optimizing, perfecting, polishing, and increasing the efficacy of a product, a service, a business process. So I find it's important for managers to understand the distinction between each and how you can use them to really drive innovation effectively at different points in your business.
Makes sense. So one more question. Talk with us about the Bright Conference. I know I see it's on next year on the 6th and 7th of March. Why would people want to come? And is it invitation only, or is it open?
No. It is open. You know, so a couple things happening in New York at Columbia. One is the Bright Conference. That's once a year, and it's a day and a half conference. It's going to be, as you said, the first Monday and Tuesday of March, again in 2017. This is a big event where we'll have about 600 or so people each year the last few years, from very diverse backgrounds in terms of industries, coming together, and it's a mix of keynote talks by, as I said, some of these, you know, CMOs, entrepreneurs who started new companies, thought leaders and authors. It's sort of a range of perspectives, as well as longer breakout sessions on the second day where you can delve into specific topics in more depth. And it's really looking at how is innovation and new technologies changing the environment and the way that we build and sustain great brands. I definitely encourage folks to check that out. It's BRITE, Bright, for Brands Innovation Technology, brightconference.com. And in addition, a couple of things that I'm involved with that are more around the year at Columbia, I have two programs for executives that I teach. You do not have to be an MBA. You don't have to be a degree student. So 3-day or 5-day programs on campus. through our executive education division. One is digital marketing, and the other is digital business strategy, which is focused on the topics we've talked about today, digital transformation. So those are programs where you can come in, and this is a smaller group. You're going to be with 25, 35 people from different countries all over the world. Typically, you know, we'll have 30 people from 20 countries, all different industries. And it's a very intense multi-day program where you're diving into both a lot of case studies and frameworks, but then working in small teams, applying the concepts, workshopping, and actually developing strategies for real-world business challenges. And really a lot of the value is the other folks who you meet. It's always a really interesting, eclectic group of businesses from around the world. So, you know, either of those that folks can make it out to New York, or if you're nearby, we're always excited to have fresh faces on Columbia University's campus up at our business school.
Awesome. Well, it's great to go to New York for the Met and Columbia. So we got to figure out a way to do that. Awesome.
Terrific.
David, thank you so much. I wanted to remind people that your Twitter handle is @David_Rogers. It's Rogers. Your latest book again is The Digital Transformation Playbook, Rethink Your Business for the Digital Age. And I'm especially liking the chapter there about platforms instead of products. I really appreciate that. And I've very much appreciated having a structured approach to this subject that I think that people, you know, I think that they think of it as like, yeah, just adding Facebook or adding some digital natives to something, but that's not really what it's about. It's about strategic thinking.
Yeah, it's a much deeper change in the organization.
That's right. So thank you again. I also
thanks
wanted to
so much.
You're welcome.
And just to let folks know, if you don't have the book, you can find out, the website is digitaltransformationplaybook.com, and you can both find out information and also download the first chapter to get a little more sense of it.
Perfect. So it's actually digitaltransformationplaybook.com. It's all one word?
That's correct. Yes.
Okay, great. Yeah, you can download the chapter. You can, of course, get it on Amazon, Barnes & Noble. I also wanted to let everybody know about next month. We're going to have Joshua Ganz, who's the author of Disruption Dilemma, on Thursday, August 18th at 11 a.m. That's 2 p.m. Eastern. And as all of you, I think, on the call know, that we are focused on disruption for this year. So we continue to find important and relevant authors to talk with us about that subject. Thanks, everybody. I will be back from the Olympic on August 18th, so I'll be able to, like, let you all know about how that went. And
what sport are you competing in, Sue?
Competing, right. I wish. I used to play volleyball, so I'll be watching volleyball.
Excellent. All right.
Volleyball. Yes.
Great.
So I'm very excited, and I wish all of you a wonderful summer, and we'll see you in a month. Thank you so much, David.
Thank you, Sue. Take care.
Okay, bye now.